Well, I see that our time has come, the bottom of the hour. So hello to everyone. A special welcome to those of you who are joining a teleclass for the first time. There are a few hundred of you who are here for the first time. Welcome aboard. And I would like to say welcome to the Weber Training teleclass, Secrets of the CBIC Test Committee. My name is Paul Weber, and on behalf of my colleague, Dr. Syed Sattar, I'd like to thank you for joining us today. For this topic, we have three faculty members and a distinguished group at that. I'll introduce each of them as their time comes, beginning with the 2006 president of the Certification Board of Infection Control, Linda Laxton. Linda works for the Department of Veterans Affairs, and I understand she has been a spectacular success as CBIC president. So to present an overview and a look at the committee structure, I am pleased to present Linda Laxton. Linda.
Thank you, Paul. I'm not sure where you got your information. That's news to me. I'm really excited to be on this presentation. And my part is to kind of go over an overview of how CBIC works. And if I may have the mission slide, Paul. The bylaws mission for CBIC is that the CBIC Incorporated is a voluntary, autonomous, multidisciplinary board which provides direction for and administers the certification process for infection control professionals. The mission of CBIC is to develop and administer a certification process designed to measure knowledge mastery of infection prevention and control and applied epidemiology. So CBIC actually develops the certification exam. Now the word I want you to key in on here is measure. Our responsibility is to measure. What's tasked to us is to assure that those who successfully obtain the CIC credential are competent at least a two-year practice level for an ICP. And the way we accomplish our task is by measuring the certificate's knowledge mastery through an examination process. Most of you are familiar with that. Next slide. Focusing again on the measurement piece, our stance on recertification is worth mentioning at this point because measurement is really the key answer. CBIC very much agrees with the growing knowledge of evidence that continuing education does not demonstrate competence, and that demonstrating competence is an ongoing process that requires repeat measurement. Next slide. The real key here is there's been a lot of controversy, and people are always saying to CBIC, why don't you allow recertification through continuing education? But each and every one of us on this line have been to training classes where people took notes, where people drew little drawings the whole time, where they looked at their day timer the whole time. Just because you attend a class doesn't mean that you acquire knowledge as a part of the class. And, you know, the real question that's hitting healthcare these days is competency. Can you say that an ICP who was certified once, who completed the exam in 1984, is still competent to deal with today's infection prevention and control requirements? I mean, that's really the bottom line. Based on those of you who are in the United States are very familiar with the Institute of Medicine's report, Do Not to Err is Human, and that really brought to light the issue that healthcare doesn't always have positive outcomes, and it's brought a lot of attention to preventing infections and assuring competency. And the competency issue is carrying forth to all levels of providers. There are certain groups in the United States who are starting to demand demonstration of competency for physicians as they become recredentialed on a periodic basis. So CBIC believes that just to attend a continuing education no longer assures or can any way measure competency. Therefore, the only way that we can actually demonstrate measured competency is to retest. So how does CBIC accomplish our mission? Next slide. First, the board of directors' composition is designed to mirror the profession of infection prevention and control. The CBIC board consists of 13 to 14 directors, and the composition mirrors the profession. By bylaws, we are required to have at least one physician, one medical technologist, or a person with a medical microbiologist degree with a BSN, one master's or higher level degree in education, because we are about testing, a minimum of four registered nurses, at least one Canadian professional. We are a North American practice standard based, and so we want to make sure that we have Canadian representation on the makeup of the exam and all that we do as a board. We try to look at alternate non-acute care settings. So we want at least one representative from non-acute care and one from long-term care. Now, the non-acute care can be any myriad of activities. It can be mental health. It can be ambulatory care. We recently had a school nurse on there who was certified in infection prevention and control. So it can cover any gamut depending upon the people who apply. Then we have one consumer director. This is a non-infection control professional, generally a business person, who helps us with marketing and with looking at the consumer's interest in certification for our particular profession. One of the key things is that every director on the CBIC board must be certified, excluding the consumer director, because he obviously would not meet the qualifications to be certified. But it's a understanding that you cannot be on the board unless you are at least first certified. That is how we assure the competency of the people who are on the board. Next slide. Now, the test committee, which is what we're here today to talk about, the test committee, it is a committee of the board. It is made up of CBIC board members, so it's a smaller subset of the board, and their function is to direct and coordinate with the testing agency all activities related to the development of the certification exam. So the test committee actually develops the exams itself. Now, this includes the computer-based test as well as the SAIR. Now, the computer-based test is what most of you have completed. That initial certification can only be completed through computer-based testing. Recertification can be completed either through computer-based testing or through the SAIR. SAIR stands for Self-Assessment Recertification Exam, and it's basically a take-home test. You know, you can take it home and you can work on it over time. We allow the SAIR to be used for recertification only because you have to document initial competency. The SAIR is at a higher level. Its initial certification is based on 2 years. The SAIR, it's harder. So it's expected that you would be able to deal with more difficult questions. The test committee itself meets face-to-face 2 to 3 times a year, depending upon the need, but does a lot of its work off-site between test committee meetings. Next slide. The test committee composition is also established by the bylaws because it's important if their primary function is to develop the exam that you have the representation of the multiple facets that make up the profession of infection prevention and control. The committee itself consists of 7 to 8 members. It must include the president-elect, the MD member, at least one microbiologist, at least one RN, the Canadian director, or if there are at least one of the Canadian directors, should there be more than one, and the director who has a master's degree in education. Now, the entire CBIC board helps to write questions called items that they help with actually writing new potential questions for the exam, but it is the test committee that actually scrutinizes those items once they're submitted and decides what will and won't go on the exam. Next slide. We want to talk just a little bit about how the test committee develops the exam. Now, the CBIC certification process is truly very structured and statistically sound, and it begins with the practice analysis. Now, this is good timing to discuss this because we just repeated the practice analysis. We do the practice analysis every 5 years, and we just distributed it in the fall. The practice analysis went to every CHICA member and almost every APIC member. And the purpose of the practice exam is to systematically collect information that describes the behaviors and activities performed by people who are in the profession of infection prevention and control. Next slide. The purpose is to determine comprehensively to determine and comprehensively describe the functions of the ICP role, what you and I do every day, and to determine the core functions that should be assessed in a certification examination. So if the goal of certification is to measure the core knowledge that is essential to all ICPs, that's what we're all about. So for example, it wouldn't be appropriate if we had a question on an exam that only 5% of all infection control practitioners in North America would ever encounter. That's not going to be a good measure of essential knowledge for an ICP. What we want to measure are the core components that would apply to the practice of infection prevention and control for most of the ICPs, regardless of the practice setting. Next slide. So therefore, we use a practice analysis to determine what those core elements are. The actual survey itself is developed by a panel of experts that includes members of CBIC, but includes non-CBIC members, non-CBIC board members as well. And it's developed to include as many activities as we think are pertinent for core elements of the job. This time, for the first time, we distributed the survey via email. And by doing that, we were able to send it to a lot more people. In the past, we've sent it to approximately 5,000. This time, we were able to send it to over 9,000. It is conducted every 5 years because you and I know that practice has changed a lot in the last 5 years. So we want to make sure that the current exam is based on the current practices of ICPs. I mentioned before that it's based on North American practice standards. We want to know what the practice is for both Canada and the United States, and that is where the core parts of it is. Next slide. Now, once we distribute the questionnaire, ICPs in every aspect of practice that includes ambulatory care, mental health, prisons, school nurses who happen to be ICPs as well, any group that's involved gets that opportunity to say what is a part of their individual job. Now, once all that comes in, we statistically analyze the data to determine the core elements that are essential for an ICP practicing with 2 years of experience out there. So using that, things that don't measure in most everybody's practice get thrown out. Things that are core to the majority of the respondents of the surveyors then can be included. And then the answers are used to develop the content outline for the certification examination itself. That's what we use to develop the test questions. So in essence, you are the ones that tell us what's to be included on the exam. Next slide. So based on the practice analysis, we take those activities that you have said or that the majority of people who responded say are key components to their job, and then we develop the content outline based on that. Now, the current content outline, and this is based on the practice analysis of 5 years ago because we're still in the process of analyzing the data from the fall survey and making the corrections. So the major content categories include identification of infectious diseases, surveillance and epidemiological investigation, preventing and controlling transmission of infectious agents, program management and communication, education and research, and infection control aspects of employee health. Those were the major activities that people said they were involved in for the most part. Now, each major section will also have multiple subsections so that the entire, so that we have multiple different areas under these that were identified as key components. If you want to review the entire content outline, you can. It's published in the Candidate Handbook. The Candidate Handbook is available through the CBIC website, and so you can get it electronically, and you can evaluate the kind of things that people have said were the core of their practice, and you can identify what we use to actually develop the specifications for the exam itself. So in closing my section, the secrets revealed so far are, first, the board members creating the CBIC exam are highly qualified ICPs. Second, representation from multiple infection prevention and control practice settings are included on the board and on the people that make up the exam. And third, the content for these items included on the exam aren't pulled out of thin air, as many people suppose, but they are actually given to the board by practicing ICPs through the practice analysis itself. Thank you, Paul.
Next, we have Sheila McDonald. Sheila is in charge of infection control at Queen Elizabeth II Health Sciences Center in Halifax. She is a past president of CHICA Canada, and most importantly for our purposes today, she is a member of the CBIC Test Committee. To give us a look at the sorts of questions that you can expect to find on the exam, I give you Sheila McDonald. Sheila.
Okay, thank you very much, Paul, and good afternoon, everyone. Thanks so much for joining us today. Linda has provided a very good overview and a background for you in regard to the testing agency and the testing the test committee, and I'm going to talk about a little bit more in detail about the actual questions and what the test committee does with those questions. As Linda mentioned, we don't just pull these questions out of thin air. We don't just sit around a table and develop them and put them out there for the exam. It's a very well-defined process, and one of the things that we do, next slide please, Paul, one of the things that we do is engage with a professional testing agency to help us with this process. And we work with an agency called Applied Measurement Professionals, and they provide professional psychometric services to the Certification Board of Infection Control and to the test committee. They provide our statistical and performance analysis on the questions. They essentially provide the statistical expertise. The infection control practitioners on the board provide the infection control content expertise. And the AMP, or Applied Measurement Professionals Group, make sure that we are following a standard process, that our items are appropriate. They look at every item that we produce, every question that we produce. They look at it from a statistical perspective. Does it perform well? Does it perform poorly? If so, why? Do we need to change that question? So they really help us in producing a very well-constructed exam and a very high-quality exam. Next slide, please. Now, getting down to the questions. The exams consist of 150 questions. The candidates are scored on 135 of those 150 questions. On our computer-based exam, there are 15 what we call pre-test questions on every exam. And they're basically new questions that are being test-run to see how they perform, but you are not scored on those questions. So you're really scored on 135 out of 150 questions on the examination. Next slide, please, Paul. Now, the test questions are very, very closely scrutinized by the test committee. A tremendous amount of work goes into this process to produce the best quality examination that we can. New questions are developed on a continuous basis, and again, as Linda mentioned previously, the entire board does produce questions. The test committee produces more questions than the other members of the CIBIC board. And every single question is scrutinized in detail before it's ever placed on a test. And I don't think people quite realize the rigor that each question is actually put through. And I'll try and explain in a little bit about how that actually works. The questions also have to be produced in conjunction with the practice analysis, which Linda mentioned. The questions have to fit in under the content outline. They have to be appropriate to North American practice. So we look at that very closely as well. Next question, please. Next slide, sorry. Scrutiny of the test questions. Each section of the content outline has a defined number of questions. And if you go to your CIBIC handbook, you can get it off the CIBIC website. The content outline is contained in that. All the areas from which questions are drawn, they're found on the CIBIC website in the content outline. For example, the identification of infectious diseases, surveillance and epidemiological investigation, preventing and controlling the transmission of infectious agents, and so on. So the outline is there, and the questions are actually fit in under that outline and, again, are based on the North American practice from the practice analysis, which is conducted every 5 years. So they have to fit in under the content outline, and each question also has to have a reference. We, as Linda said, again, we don't pull these out of thin air. We do have a reference from a defined reference list, and again, if you go to the CIBIC website, pull up the handbook, the reference list is there, and those are the references from which the questions on which the questions will be based. Next slide, please. Again, looking at the question, what do we look at? I'm going to go into an example in a moment. Every question has a stem, or the question itself, we call them stems, and of course the answers we call the options. As you know, for those of you who have written the examinations, the CIBIC examinations are all multiple choice. There are no essay questions, etc. Next slide, please. Okay, so what sorts of things do we look for? For example, is the stem and are the options grammatically correct? Does it flow? Is it clear? Does it make sense when you read it? This is a time-limited exam. You have 150 questions, and you have to answer them within a certain period of time. We don't want you to have to go through a lot of superfluous information to get to the point. So is it written clearly? Is the stem perhaps too long? Could it be altered without actually altering the intent of the question or altering the question altogether? Next slide, please. Have the irrelevant pieces of information been eliminated? I'm going to show you an example of that in a moment. Has negative wording been avoided? We do try to avoid negativisms in our questions. They're hard to read, and if at all possible, we try to avoid them. We can't 100%, but we are working on it, folks. Does the content classification fit with the question? Is it appropriate? And is the reference correct? And also, is the reference up to date? We don't want to use a reference that that is perhaps 1994, but yet there's a more up-to-date reference within the last few years. So we look at that very carefully. What is the most recent reference? What is the most recent scientific information or guideline or standard? Next slide, please. Okay, let's take an example to demonstrate a little bit about what the test committee actually does and how we pick a question apart, and we do pick these questions apart. Everyone on the board submits X number of questions, and then we go at them. All right, let's just have a look at this. A patient has been admitted to one of the general medicine nursing units in your hospital. The person is homeless, a known drug abuser, and has been admitted for investigation of a chronic cough and weight loss. A PPD has been ordered. Okay, next slide, please. The test is administered in the following manner, and the options are subcutaneous, intramuscular, intradermal, orally. Now, that is a very poorly written question. All right, and I'm going to tell you how we would pick that apart. Paul, could you just go back to the previous slide for a moment? Thank you. The patient has been admitted to one of the general medicine nursing units in your hospital. Now, this tells you why the PPD has been ordered and so on. It gives you lots of background information, but remember I said this is a time-limited test. Next slide, please. And when you're looking at what the question is asking, the test is administered in the following manner. Really, what you're asking is, how is your tuberculin skin test administered? What is the appropriate administration route? Okay, that's the question. That's the knowledge you're testing. That's what you want to know. Does the ICP know the answer to this? So you really don't need all that superfluous information in the stem of the question. Interesting, but you really don't need it in order to answer the question. And if you look at the options, okay, if you look at the answers, A, B, C, and D, you've got adjectives and adverbs mixed up. It's not very uniform. So it's not really a particularly well-written question. You can figure out what they're asking, but it's not particularly well-written. Next slide, please. Now, the test committee would take a question like that and revise it. And they would probably come up with something like this. The appropriate administration route of a TST, or tuberculin skin test, is A, subcutaneous, intrathecal, intramuscular, intradermal. Your stem is now very much shortened. It gets right to the point. It's more clearly written. You don't have all that extraneous information that you don't really need in order to answer the question. And your options are uniform. You're not mixing adjectives and adverbs and so on. Your options are more uniform. So they would do something like that with that particular question. The other thing about this question is that it's a very simple question, actually, and Sharon is going to talk about what we call cognitive levels in her section next. But this is what we would call a recall question or a cognitive level one. It's straight knowledge. You don't need to have a number of concepts in order to answer the question. You either know the answer or you don't. It is straight recall or straight knowledge. It's quite a simple question. You either know it or you don't. So when we take the question, sometimes when we submit questions as board members, we would never recognize them after the test committee gets their hands on them. We would never know which question was ours after they have literally ripped it apart and scrutinized it and made it as clear. It made it the best question possible. So that's an example of how the test committee would take every single question and do something similar with it. Now, as you advance into the cognitive levels, the questions become more difficult, and it's not always as simple. That was a fairly easy one to revise. They're not all that simple as you get into analysis questions and so on. Next slide, please. Okay, now, a few tips. What I would suggest, if you have not written the exam before, prepare using the content outline. And again, I'm going to ask you, go to the CIBIC website, pull up the handbook, read it from stem to stern. Everything you need to know about how to get moving on writing that exam is in that handbook. Look at the content outline. That's where the questions are going to come from. That's the kind of knowledge that we're going to be testing. Prepare using the listed references. Again, they're in the handbook. And prepare well in advance of the exam. Don't do this at the 11th hour, folks. It will be a major stress for most people. exam writing is never what I would call fun for anyone, no matter how smart you are. So prepare well in advance. And the outcome, next slide, please, I hope will be that you pass the exam. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Sheila. The third and final section of this teleclass is titled Now for the Real Secrets of the CIBIC Test Committee, and this will be presented by Sharon Christofiak. Sharon, I hope I said that right.
You did.
Sharon is the chair of the 2006 CIBIC Test Committee. She is the manager of the Infection Control Department of Mercy Hospital in Pittsburgh. She teaches several courses, and she is the author of a fantastic book entitled New Threat of Drug-Resistant Microbes, The Return of Untreatable Common Infections. I believe that's now in its fourth or even fifth edition. So to present the real secrets of the CIBIC Test Committee, I turn things over to Sharon Christofiak. Sharon.
Thanks, Paul. Good afternoon or good morning to some of you. One of the first things I want to tell you before we start on my group of slides is one of the real secrets is sometimes lately we have been pulling these questions out of thin air. One of the first things that I learned as the chair of the test committee this year was that I've gotten a chance to look at some of the evaluations that those of you may have filled out after you've completed an exam. And it was something that generally hadn't been shared before, and I was amazed at how many people were questioning, you know, where did you get this question? It's very interesting. There has been so much change in our lives as infection prevention and control specialists. We're now starting to look at some of the things that happen on a daily basis and have been able to use our experiences to come up with great questions. So don't think that we're still just looking in the book, picky little questions that we can try and trick you with. A lot of things are real-life things that have happened to a lot of us on the committee or other people in our chapters. So we're trying to get more real-life scenarios. Secret one. Secret two, or probably not so secretive, our tests are based on what's called cognitive learning principles. If any of you have had any kind of education courses, and I know many of you have, you're probably familiar with the concept of the different domains of education. And there are three domains that we primarily deal with. The affective domain, which is when you're dealing with beliefs and feelings and very touchy-feely type subjects, would not be something that's germane to the practice of infection control. So those we don't test on. There's not usually references either. The psychomotor domain is more things like hand-eye coordination. And a lot of professional groups do test on such things. Linda and I had the opportunity last fall to go to a NOCA conference where we met with lots of people from other fields with an eye-opening experience, but they actually did psychomotor testing for competency. If perhaps you were in the industry of building or repairing computers, where you really needed to know how to put things together or take things apart, they had actual movement-type studies to do their competency evaluations. Because we're in more of a hard knowledge and cognitive domain, we are basing all of our multiple choice questions on the cognitive domain. And it breaks down into seven or eight different groups. We only really test on three of them. And as Sheila had mentioned, the first one is recall. And this is the most simple part of information, pretty much regurgitation. Can you complete the sentence without even seeing the options? The example Sheila gave you, tuberculin skin test would be performed by, you didn't even need to read the options in the keys. You knew what the answer was, that it was going to be intradermal. So there's a certain number on all tests that are primarily this recall type question. There are other questions that are considered application, which generally means there's two pieces of information that you would need either in the question or in your experience, to be able to reach the correct answer. And it's a higher level of learning. Analysis is not the highest level in the cognitive domain, but it's the highest we can test for. The highest is actually synthesis. But we can't ask you to come up with solutions that we could measure in a multiple choice test. So analysis means that you're trying to come up with different answers based on the information we give you, but at least there should be three pieces of information that you have to put together to come up with the correct answer. And these are probably the toughest for most of us to have to answer, definitely the toughest for us to have to write, to make it a valid question, something important, something without a lot of irrelevant information in, but something that really can break apart, do you know the profession and how to deal with the correct situation in which you're dealing? Next question, or next slide. So all of our exam questions, once we've gotten them together as the test committee, and they're put onto the pre-testing status, we want to make sure that the appropriate wording was used. We may think it sounds fine, but again, it's a relatively small group of people looking at this. It could be because we've got such a broad group of people taking the exams that maybe there is something there, a colloquialism, a word we shouldn't have used. So when AMP gets the results back from any given testing, they will look to see if too many people have missed a question. Maybe we used the wrong type of wording. Maybe it could be made more clear. They also look to see how many candidates get each question correct. And this is something that they do very detailed information on. They want to make sure that all of the possible answers were selected by somebody. If you remember back to your elementary and high school training, there were always questions where you knew that, well, you could throw this one out. It definitely isn't that. We try very hard not to have any answers that aren't plausible, that somebody might select if they didn't truly know the profession and have the knowledge base to be guaranteed the CIC exam, the CIC credential. They also look to see if the high-scoring candidates got it correct. We've understood several instances where people that really knew that type of question in and out may know more about current content. If people that really know the profession well make a mistake and don't get the question correct, maybe there's new references out there and we'll have to go look. Perhaps the field has changed. And occasionally we've had to double score a question because knowledge has changed since when the time the original question was generated and got on the test. So they do a lot of very detailed things that those of us on the test committee don't see. But they will tell us when we have the next test committee meeting that we need to rework a question. Next slide, please. Somehow they come up with statistics for each question. And just looking at some of the information they have in their database, it's amazing, but it really keys us off to how we know we need to change something and improve our questions constantly. Next slide. So each exam we put together has to be somewhat equivalent to previous tests. If it's in the five-year time period where we're dealing with a specific practice analysis, the breakdown is always the same. We want it to be on the same type topics, and because it's based on the content outline, I know many of you have said that there were no questions on construction. The last practice analysis that was performed back in 1991, we weren't really involved in construction and the infection control risk assessment. Now, this is something that will be coming up from the last practice analysis, so we'll be adding questions to the future tests that will be coming out. So we have to have a different percentage for easy and difficult questions, the same recall and analysis and application questions, so that you can't say, well, I took this exam this year, but last year's was an easier test. It's got to be a fair measure of your knowledge. We should have approximately the same passing score because all the questions are stratified with difficulty in making sure they're correct and they're accurate. As Linda mentioned, the computer-based test, because it's a timed exam, this exam is accredited by the National Commission on Certifying Agencies, and they have specific parameters for what consists of an accepted exam. We because of all of our statistics, and we can't explain all of it for time constraints, have to make sure that we comply with all the NOCA requirements and have to actually fill out documentation and can be audited by our NCCA to make sure that we are following all of the appropriate things to be considered a certified test. The SAIR, on the other hand, for those of you that have taken it, you know that it's an open book exam. It's not secure. Many of our chapters will get together and actually study from it, have study groups, and it's a wonderful learning tool. So it's not NCC accredited. We can't use that pretty much as an advanced practice exam. We had considered it, but it's not something that's secure. So that continues to be an available option for recertification, but not for initial certification. Next slide, please. So now for the real secrets. You've heard all the background statistical information. As we've all said, it's based on North American practice, but what you may not be aware of is that it's being taken all over the world. Last year we had exams given in Hong Kong, in Saudi Arabia, throughout the continents of Europe, Asia, all over the world where AMP has testing sites. And they all require the same security, that you would have to have a letter, you would have to have picture identification. Pictures are taken, actually, of the candidates as they're taken, just to verify security. It's all very high-tech, but it ensures that it's a good exam and you don't have someone who maybe really isn't the person that signed up for the test actually showing up at the testing center. We've tried very hard to eliminate all references to any of the national organizations. For those of us that have taken the test previously, you may know that there were questions that had things like OSHA regulations or Joint Commission, things like this. We have tried very hard to take them all out. If it isn't something that applies pretty much to the entire world, it isn't something that we should expect our colleagues in Hong Kong to have to know all the standards in the United States and Canada. The question should be applicable to infection prevention throughout the world. So it's something that we're trying very hard to include things like the World Health Organization so that it is truly a world test. Next slide, please. We heard from looking at some of the evaluations, people have said that there were trick questions. This is something totally not of intention, and we've tried so hard to make sure that they're not trick questions. So as Sheila said, the purpose of the exam is to measure your knowledge, not your test-taking skills. We've gotten rid of all of those superfluous things in the STEM that you really don't need to know, the red herrings. There are occasionally things that may be distracting, but you should know if you're the advanced practitioner that this is something that has no reference, no variability with what the answer is that you're going to come up with. There's no special tricks in this test, such as if in doubt, pick A. There's more A answers. I don't know that there are any more of any particular letter. We also try very hard to make sure that our answer possibilities are all about the same length. One of the high school tricks that many of us knew was you always pick the longest answer for any question because that's probably, if you don't know the answer, the right one. It's not something that's good for discrimination, for infection control proficiency, and it's not something you're going to find in the civic exam. We're working really hard to eliminate the negatively worded questions and all the above questions. The except is one of the words that those of us on the test committee frequently even make mistakes when we have to pre-take a test that's going to be put out on the web. We all take the exam, and anytime we mess up, it's usually the ones that we've misread the STEM for. So we're getting rid of all those questions that have the big words except. If there is a question that we haven't been able to effectively come up with a better question without using the concept of except, we generally tend to have that in capital letters so that it's something that you can look for and reread the question before making a mistake in the answer. Next slide, please. We've also heard from your comments that you say, but these scenarios don't apply to me. I work for an ambulance company. I work in a behavioral health setting. One of the tricks we're going to teach you today, hopefully, is reread the question. try and figure out what we're really trying to measure. What is the information you need to know? Drill down to be asked exactly what are we trying to determine, and then put your work situation into the same question. Next slide, please. For example, question might read, the nurse manager of your burn unit calls to report that the physicians noticed an increase in the number of Acinetobacter baumannii infections in the unit. What would you do to verify their concerns? And for those of you that are working in a long-term care facility or a prison setting, the school nurse, a burn unit is not something everybody has, and people tend to panic. This is a stressful situation. It's a timed exam, and say, I've never worked in a hospital that had a burn unit. I couldn't possibly know the answer to this, and this is an unfair exam. Next slide, please. Take two. Look at that question again, but now highlight the part that doesn't apply to you. Burn unit, Acinetobacter baumannii. It sounds so technical, but if you can get rid of those two words, and if you go to the next slide, take three, and fill in the blank that applies to your particular setting. If you were working in perhaps a psychiatric hospital, if you fill in the blanks and say, the nurse manager of your behavioral health unit calls to report the physicians noticed an increase in the number of upper respiratory tract infections in the unit. Oh, well, you know that answer. Or if you're working in a rehab facility and you put in rehab floor, and perhaps you're looking at cases of diarrhea. Oh, know that answer too. Try and look at questions that you find that may not be in your scope of practice and just replace it, reread the question, and answer something that would apply to you. Dialysis centers, patients with HCV. Next slide. Because what we're trying to find out is if you're aware of the principle that's going to be applied. What kind of test are you going to do? Are you going to be doing a case control study? You may be asked to say, what percentage of an increase had you noticed above baseline? It could be a statistical question. So don't let the question throw you. It's not meant to. And it's kind of a test-taking strategy that truly is a secret for people that are very test-savvy. Not to be thrown by the question, but just try and reread it and remain calm. And 99% of the time, you do know the answer. Next slide. Since we've talked about the exam designed to measure your knowledge of principles, what we want you to be aware of is the CIC credential that you get when you successfully pass the exam says that you're marketable throughout the wonderful world of healthcare, or sometimes not so wonderful world. You could be working in the correction facility, and you've got your CIC diploma in hand, but tomorrow you could be offered a position at a large metropolitan health center, or vice versa. What we're really trying to get at is to say that somebody who possesses this type of knowledge can work in a wide variety of fields. And this is one of the reasons we think it's a really important credential for people to have, because it does say that you've got a very broad base of education, training, and experience. Next slide. Now, in case you're more afraid of taking the computer-based part, many of us took the pencil and paper exam that was given years ago, and we've tried to phase that out. It's much easier to be able to score and give you immediate answers back, did you pass, if you're using computer-based testing. So we do have an online practice exam available that you can take. It's available if you go through the CivicOrg website. But essentially what we've done is taken 70 questions, some of which were retired from previous exams, may not necessarily reflect current practice, but they were good questions. But you can go through on your own time frame, your own personal computer at work or at home, and go through how you do the actual testing process. Which buttons do I push? Where do I find this? How do I go back? How do I get a score? The administration charges $50 to take the practice exam, but it will also not only give you confidence in taking the computerized part, but kind of give you an idea of how the multiple choice questions will come up, how they're arranged, how you can go back, review questions. So we've had some colleagues that have taken it and really found it to be very soothing, calming, and reassuring, and that it's not something that's way beyond your skills. Those of us in the field are so used to dealing with computers, but computer-based testing is something we don't do that often. So we don't want you to be afraid of that part. So please, if you want to see how it works, think about taking the practice exam. Next slide, please. The Civic Executive Office, as Linda mentioned, is in Lenexa, Kansas, and they provide the services. It's through Applied Measurement Professionals, and we've got their logo at the bottom. Their contact information is provided, and you can send them emails, faxes. They're wonderful about getting back to you in a timely manner. And if it's anything specific that you have questions with, if they don't know the answers or can't provide them, it's a technical question, they forward your questions or your comments to those of us on the board. And then we will get back to you or someone else from their office if it's something with technical or computers, settings, et cetera. But one of us will get back to you relatively shortly. So please feel free to send any comments to the executive office. If you go to the Civic website, you will also find the current directors are available if you need to send any one of us an email, those of us that are on the presentation today or otherwise, just with comments or questions, and we will get those emails and get back to you also. Next slide. So since I get to close, on behalf of the entire Civic Board, we'd like to thank you and are really pleased that you signed in today and got to listen to us. There is another presentation coming up about the practice analysis, but in the meantime, I think we have a few minutes, and if it's okay with Paul, we'd all like to take your questions if you have any. And thanks again.
Thank you, Sharon, and thank you as well to Sheila and Linda. Excellent information, and a lot of people have registered for this teleclass, I think a lot more than average, so that tells you the desire for CIC certification.
Paul, can I clarify two quick things?
Certainly.
As I was listening here that came up, just so people know, because some of these two things get confused sometimes. First of all is just the terminology. We have both a lot of Canadian and American people on the call, and Sheila, who's our Canadian rep on the board at this time, used the term write the exam. That is a Canadian term which means take the exam. It doesn't mean write the questions for the exam. So for those American participants, that took me a little bit of getting used to when I first went on the board, because when I hear write the exam, I think you mean content. So that's not what you meant. And then the second thing to clarify, because this has been an issue for a couple of Canadian certificates, and I apologize in advance for this. The computer-based testing was first established in the United States, then it went international. The process for doing the exam internationally, which does include Canada, is slightly different than the United States. And it's different because of the security measures that are in place in the groups where AMP negotiates computer time with. The security measures are very different. So therefore, for international certificates, you will not get your results at the time you take the exam. They will be mailed to you. There was just recently an issue. Someone from Canada had taken the APIC certification review course and was told that they would get their results immediately, because that is what happens in the United States. But it is a process that we are working on. We are hoping to get different computer systems that will allow that security. But it in order to maintain our NOCA accreditation, we currently at this point do not have the measures that will allow us to give immediate results. We hope to correct that, but just so people know, and not get there and be disappointed that they don't know when they walk out the door what they did, how they did. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you, Linda. And speaking of people who write the test from outside of North America, is the CIC recognized outside of North America? We have quite a few people from overseas who are listening to this call.
Yes. We have certificates in over 25 different countries now.
Am I to understand that if you want to renew or recertify, that you can take the computer-based test as well as the SHARE, or can you only take the SARE, S-A-R-E?
Either.
Either or. Okay, thank you.
You have to take it the computer the first time at your first five-year point.
Okay.
When your certification is due for 5 years. At that point, you can recertify either by computer-based or the SARE.
Thank you.
And you can actually take the SARE for years and years, every 5 years, and then go back to computer-based testing. There's always the option for any recertification for either exam.
I have a question about locations of exam and the possibility of writing in Canada or perhaps going to Syracuse. Is that an option as a writing center? And could you find out your exam results immediately?
If you do it in the United States, you can get your exam results immediately. The testing center locations are listed on the website.
Okay.
Go to the website. It will actually take you, it's a link to the AMP's website, but it will list all the testing centers because sometimes there's more than one in a city. Not all cities have test sites. So if you go to the website, you can check both in Canada and the United States. There is also a new link we just added to the website for international testing, which has some of the differences for international testing, as I mentioned before.
A big thanks again to Linda, Sheila, and Sharon for sharing their wisdom with us today. And thanks to all of you for making this a very successful teleclass. Until we meet again, goodbye.